wicked smile.
Production lines, helping to drive down the price of oil from $3.50 a barrel in the opening days of 1990 to a mere $13.60 a barrel by summer.
You have to understand the difference. We didn't come over on the Nina, the Pinta, and the whatchamacallit. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us. Landed right on top of us.
Without cry. Why? You can get all the film and the footage of all the carnage in Los Angeles, but you can show me no footage of any damage in Iraq. And all you show me is some surgical
fight.
Now, 1 year later, it comes out that these so-called surgical fights were mixed in, and they were missing their targets.
Money, the root of all evil, some say. However, one thing is for sure, money has a contaminating control over our lives. It is sought after, fought over, prayed over. Never has one word meant so much to so many people. Money reaches deep into our lives, and it stands as an inescapable reality of the modern Western civilized illusion. An illusion played out daily by billions of people. The illusion that a simple piece of paper has value, money has sculptured our very lives and has been the instrument by which the greedy and ungodly have manipulated, controlled, and exploited.
You buy and sell money the same way as you buy and sell apples and oranges. We never see it, we never touch it. It's all numbers on a screen.
Around the clock, around the planet, money is on the move. Just a cyber-charged electronic pulse. Money throughout history has had no hard and fast definition. Rock, salt, gold, it is even edible. With the introduction of money, local transactions were opened up to a global audience. Since those early days, money has been the secret weapon that fueled revolutions, and it has shaped and molded the planet that we live on. In its most basic form, money represents raw power. The Lydians of Greece were said to be the originators of gold and silver coins. Their invention of metallic coinage was a catalyst in the commercial revolution that transformed Greek civilization during the 7th century BC. It was from these metallic coins that maritime empires were built, and as the Greek cities grew in wealth and splendor, it was an accepted fact that money stood as a force to be reckoned with.
Here in the British Museum, we've got something like 750,000 coins in our collection. It's one of the most immediate sources of contact that we have with what went on in the ancient world. You put an ancient coin in your hand, you can imagine the biography of the coin, however many hundreds of people handled this coin, what they did with it, what the services, the functions that the coin performed.
The word money originates from the false goddess Juno Monitor. She was heralded by ancient Rome as a window on the future, offering consultation and warning. Rome had begun as a city of brick, but by the age of the emperors, had become a city of marble. The Romans inherited the use of money from the Greeks, and they spread it all around Europe. Money was at the forefront of Roman conquest. Its standardization meant a common ground of comparison, a way to quantify a person's value or worth. Money defines societal hierarchy. It helps unify an empire that stretched from the northern Atlantic to western Asia. When Caesar was brutally murdered on the 15th of March, 44 BC, an obituary coin forged with the faces of his slayers, Brutus and Cassius, was pressed. Rome was hungry for the spoils of war, and more it was becoming a society revolving around excess and wealth. The word crass, originating from Marcus Crassus, one of the richest and most unscrupulous Romans of his day. Rome, once a nation filled with enviable virtue and beautiful rhetoric, now had become indulgent and lazy. Wealth and the accumulation of it took precedence over everything.
In a sense, the Romans weren't meant
to care about cash. They're meant. Their morality says what a man is worth is his virtue, what he can contribute to the state. And actually, to be counting material goods is seen as sordid.
The fall of Pompeii would come to be seen as one of the ultimate results of excesses of money. They worshipped Mercury, the false god of trade. Pompeii had been destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, which had buried the city under mounds of ash. Archaeological findings revealed numerous lava-covered corpses gripping, clutching, and rushing for their wealth, even in the final hour. Pre-industrial Rome had a booming population of 1 million, which by ancient standards is comparable to New York City today. A veritable melting pot of cultures, Rome assimilated technologies, peoples, and wealth through their relentless and ruthless conquests. The term citizen of Pax Romana was one of the noblest utterances of the day, a model copied by Pax Americana.
In ancient Rome, e pluribus unum meant exactly the same thing it means to us. They built a society where they took from many different races and creeds and nationalities, and everybody who came into their world, which was a pretty big world, became a Roman.
By the 4th century, Rome was a broken city, sacked and burnt by the Goths. The drive that had made them great had vanished. Europe had turned inward, but the money-making machine continued as the roads to riches turned eastward. Four centuries after the fall of Rome, a new power arose from the Arabian deserts. The soldiers of the seal of Prophet Muhammad came with the message of Islam. Islam, unlike any other religion, not only came embodied with the classical tenets associated with religion, but also had bound in the noble Quran the manner of economics and trade. A vast free trade zone spread from Spain to China. Ibn Battuta, one of the world's greatest explorers, would in one lifetime travel over 70,000 miles, four times further than his famous contemporary Marco Polo. Travel of this kind became more frequent in the Islamic Empire, fueled by the circulation of money, commerce, and trade. The new international currency of this splendid empire was the Islamic gold and silver dinar. The money that Ibn Battuta took with him from Spain was recognized in Africa, India, and far-reaching China. Today, a media and political veil has been drawn between Islam and the Western world, obscuring much of the beautiful and colorful history. The Middle Ages were witness to an Islamic Renaissance. Kingdoms celebrated their cosmopolitan cities, palaces of outstanding grace and grandeur embellished with stunning decoration. Trade was dictated on religious grounds, courts of business law were highly developed, derived from the noble Quran, and it is on these principles that fairness and clean trade were born. Greed and hoarding were globally despised, and a beautiful balance was established between financial and religious prosperity. Charity in the form of zakat, almsgiving to the poor, allowed a nation to sustain everyone at a high standard of living. The gross class divisions between rich and poor were non-existent in this era.
Money became an important connection between the different parts of the Muslim world because Muslim money needed to be unified for tax purposes. In order to pay one's charity tax or zakat, or to pay for offenses and crimes, the value of the money had to be standardized. By doing so, these coins became accepted in all parts of the House of Islam.
The power of Islamic money was formidable, but only as strong as its source of gold. A new source would be found in Africa. By the time Ibn Battuta attempted the crossing, a gold route through the Sahara was well established. A trading post on the Trans-Sahara could expect a yearly turnover of 400,000 dinar, billions by today's standards. When enterprising Muslim mariners navigated the Indian monsoon waters around India, the merchants that followed found China in 1346. Ibn Battuta, on his travels to China, discovered the new and amazing practice of buying and selling by paper notes. Silk, spices, gunpowder, gold, paper and print now moved on a current of money, paper money.
You had coins worth virtually nothing, which were strung together in strings of 1,000 and traded that way. Somebody finally got the idea, why not just make a paper certificate and trade that?
It would be centuries before Europe would adopt the use of paper currency. Meanwhile, a revolution in mathematics was born from the Islamic universities in Cairo, Baghdad, and Fez. Islamic scientists had perfected algebra, geometry, and the concept of the zero. They had also introduced the numerical system still in use today. Throughout his travels, Ibn Battuta testified to the wonders of the Islamic Empire. Fez captured his heart, and he settled and made it his home. The mosque, worship and prayer are all elements of a past empire, which has been preserved. Fridays are known as Jummah, a day of communal prayer. For 1400 years, the Islamic community upheld the no-trade policy during this period. Upon completion of the communal prayers, or Salat, trade is enthusiastically recommended. Throughout the Islamic Empire, a harmonious relationship between commerce and religion has existed. It is this relationship that has kept commerce pure. The charging of interest, dishonesty, and greed are known elements associated with money. However, the great Islamic empires stand as alternatives to this norm. An empire built on the economic principles of a religion kept an entire nation both prosperous and godly for centuries.
ضاع الإسلام يا يما باسم القانون ضاع تحكو للإنسان الشرعية نسيوا المواجع نسيوا الأبط المحزون
In Florence, the birthplace of the Renaissance, a whole new banking system was about to emerge. Banco is in effect an Italian word which means wooden table. And it was on these wooden tables that currency was exchanged for the illustrious golden florin, a golden coin of reputed quality. The florin merchants controlled the coin, and by the 13th century, the Islamic numerals had been adopted by Europe. Money changers became bankers, and merchants began experimenting in long-distance transactions and investments. The traveler's check first appeared in 14th century Florence. This valuable means of commerce provided a secure way of effecting international trade, as it allowed merchants to travel without carrying large quantities of gold, an obvious target for thieves and pirates.
Traveling across Western Europe at this time in the 13 and 1400s is dangerous. You have something which only you can cash. It's a piece of paper guaranteeing payment from one merchant or goldsmith to another. It's as good as gold, but nobody else can use it. It's very, very safe money.
The Medicis were a prominent and powerful banking family. Politics and money for the Medicis were inseparable. In 1433, control of the politicians fell into the hands of a rival family, which used the death of Giovanni Medici to seize political power. His eldest son, Cosmo Medici, was arrested and false accusations were made against him. His life was at risk. Through a series of bribes, he narrowly escaped death at the hands of his enemies. From this point on, he seized control of the Florentian political arena. It was said that he could rule the nation from his workshop. Though his fortune soared, Cosmo Medici always held a humble appearance, owning a mule instead of a horse. Because the Medicis were Catholic, the amassing of great wealth carried a stain in the Christian circles. Two roads to redemption lay at their feet, sponsoring great works of art and building magnificent churches. The financial favors that the Medici bestowed on presidents and popes had far-reaching consequences. Many great monuments still remain today bearing testimony to the Medici name. For more than a century, the Italians were the power brokers in the West, whilst the Ottoman Turks guarded the trade routes to the East. However, the pursuit of gold for the Spanish would create empires almost overnight and take money to new frontiers. A merger of the old world with the new was about to take place in a marriage that would influence history forever. When Christopher Columbus set sail in the name of Christ, Spain, honor, and greed, he stumbled on a magnificent and peaceful civilization of Amerindians, who had occupied this region for millions of years. His proud declaration of a new world came at a great price to the unfortunate Indians. To the people of this aptly named New World, gold had less of a financial value and more of a sacred religious one. Amerindian chiefs of the Andes in South America painted themselves with a sheen of gold as part of an elaborate religious ceremony. The chief would then dive into a lake to return the gold to the earth from which it had come. The Spanish, however, had a less symbolic depth to their gold cravens. In their campaign to conquer the region, the Spanish raped, pillaged, and plundered in an insatiable and unrelenting pursuit of gold. Death followed the gold in predacious numbers. When a mountain was discovered in Potosí, South America spewed out masses of silver. The Spanish started to believe that they were chosen by God to inherit wealth and power. But with this wealth came a hidden curse. Back in Spain, prices increased by 400%, and numerous small wars broke out across Europe. With this new wealth in 1588, 150 ship armada was amassed and launched against England. The unfortunate fleet was torn in utter defeat and humiliation at the hands of a freak storm. Spanish royalty and nobility were oblivious to these events and continued to spend extravagant amounts of money on churches and art. Perhaps by investing money into churches was a way of justifying the horrific acts in which they had indulged in the pursuit of money. Within a century, the Kingdom of Spain was fading. The power was slipping into the hands of a few skillful and manipulative individuals. Individuals who would almost single-handedly control the outcome of wars and revolutions. London, England consists in reality of two cities, the financial district and the rest of the capital, including Crown Land. For nearly 1,000 years, the city and the crown have been as separate as church and country. The Queen must even request permission to enter the 1 square mile financial enclave that makes up the city. It even has its own unique police force. The roots of this arrangement are based upon money. In 1694, the Bank of England made an alteration that would change Britain and its money forever. The ensuing war against France was draining the crown of money, and a private fund was set up to assist the financially torn nation. The Bank of England was formed as a private venture funded by wealthy financiers such as international banker William Paterson, who was noted for boastfully saying that
the bank half benefits off interest on all money it creates from nothing.
The liberation of business activity of royal prerogative allowed the British economy to surpass that of Europe's. Money now marched side by side with England's might. In 1814, money was needed in the war against Napoleon. The Bank of England, however, could not meet this request. Money was needed for the waging war, but this time the money came from the Jewish banking families who served from the shadows the needs of kings and countries. In Europe, the role of the money changer became a shadowy one, being the domain of the exiled. Because of the networking nature of Jewish families, they took control of this profession. seven generations of the Rothschilds have been involved in the banking business. The Rothschilds distinguished themselves as the most famous of all European banking dynasties. For some 200 years, they exerted great influence on the economic and indirectly the political history of Europe. Lionel de Rothschild.
Remember that all the little principalities there had different currencies and coinage, and so someone with a good memory and a quick wit could learn to do coin exchange and currency exchange.
250 years ago, Major Rothschild grew up in the Jew Street in Frankfurt, a place of cramped and subhuman conditions referred to as the ghetto, from where the modern word ghetto was derived. Major Rothschild became one of Frankfurt's richest Jews. Despite this, he was confined to the impoverished Yangasso every night. During the American Revolution, Prince Wilhelm made great profits by forcing the peasants into fighting the British wars against the American colonists. However, he was paid in English currency and had to turn to Major Rothschild to convert it to his local currency. When Napoleon had overrun Prussia, Prince Wilhelm fled, leaving his fortune to be hid among the Rothschild investments. The Rothschilds' enterprise now spread across the cities of Europe, run by Major Rothschild's sons. Nathan Rothschild, one of the five sons, had inherited his father's gift. He was sent to England to tap its industrial might and supply Europe with goods. Napoleon's tight blockade proved, however, to be a major obstacle to him. The Rothschilds hence devised an ingenious courier system, which hid delicate financial papers and gold away from Napoleon's blockades. The contributions of the Rothschilds' money to the economy of Britain was impossible to ignore. And so, at Waterloo, it was a Rothschild-financed army that crushed Napoleon. The Rothschilds made an enormous fortune from the war, and more importantly, amassed great influence and power in the whole of Europe. Over 400 billion US dollars are in circulation. It remains the most popular currency in the world. On every American dollar is the signature of Mary Eileen Withrow, the Treasurer of the United States.
Credit in the United States government. We want people to believe in it. We want them to feel they can trust it. People will use what they can trust.
Benjamin Franklin is one of the most significant faces on the American $1 bill. Born in 1706 into a poor family of 10, at the age of 12 he was apprenticed to a printer. Unknown to many, Benjamin Franklin was the most powerful hand in the introduction of paper money in the US. The problem with America's economy was due to the tax, which had to be paid to the British masters in silver. This depletion created a severe shortage and a deflation of the currency. Benjamin Franklin saw an opportunity to profit from the economic play and made a proposition to the US government to introduce paper money on a full scale. The contract was issued, and Benjamin Franklin's power and influence grew, an influence with Masonic ends.
The success in the printing business is to get the contract for printing money. You don't even have to charge, just take care of the scrap.
By 1760, the printing of paper money was banned, and England demanded their taxes in coins. Benjamin Franklin was a clear loser where England was concerned, and he used his power and position with the government to create one of America's greatest conspiracies, the War of American Independence. A war that freed America of British dominance. A war that introduced a new market for its founders, namely Benjamin Franklin. In 1776, paper money was started up once again, and it is this money that was used to finance the war against Britain. Richard Doty of the Smithsonian.
As long as the revolution appeared to be going well, continental currency or the continental dollar held up value fairly well against real coins. But when the war went on indefinitely, the value of it began to drop.
With overprinting and the soaring of counterfeiting, inflation took its toll. In fact, inflation became so high that even counterfeiting stopped as the money lost all value. 80 years passed until paper currency was tried again in America. Benjamin Franklin, however, left more than his face on the US currency. He left a symbol of masonry, the all-seeing eye. An adequate supply of money is indispensable to the so-called civilized world. Without money, industry would grind to a halt. The entire economic web would freeze. The only survivors would be self-dependent tribes and families. Money is truly the blood of society. It is the means of all trade. It is a measure and the instrument by which commodities are exchanged. Money circulation in a country is regulated by specialist bodies, usually government-based. If too much money is made, then money loses its value, causing what we know as inflation. Prices soar to compensate, interest rates soar even higher, and the country is left in financial chaos. On the other hand, shortage of money has effects that are equally devastating. Testimony to this is the Great American Depression of the 1930s. In the 1930s, America did not lack industrial capacity, fertile land, skilled workers, or entrepreneurial businessmen. It had an extensive and highly efficient transportation system in the form of railways, network roads, and inland and outland waterways. Communication between regions and localities were the best in the world, utilizing telephones, teletype, radio, and a well-organized government operating mailing system. No war had ravaged the cities or the countryside. No pestilence weakened the population, nor had famine stalked the land. The United States of America lacked only one thing, an adequate supply of money to carry on trade and commerce. In the early 1930s, bankers, the only source of new money, had refused loans to new industries, stores, and farms. Payments on existing loans were required, and money rapidly declined from circulation. Goods lay in shop windows. Jobs were waiting to be done. The money drought brought an entire nation to a standstill. The greedy bankers had put America and Americans into depression. The bankers' plot had been successful. They were now the sole benefactors, accumulating thousands of homes, farms, and business properties. It was World War II that brought the depression to a sudden end. The uncooperative bankers of peaceful times had suddenly become cooperative with billions to spare to the military. A nation that only 2 years ago could not produce food for sale now suddenly bombarded German and Japanese soil with expensive complementary missiles. The bankers' artificial creation of a money shortage had left a nation devastated. For America, it became evident that he who controlled the money controlled the nation. Money clouds judgment at a global level. Politicians financed by criminal bodies are reluctant to pass legislations affecting the hand that feeds them. However, John Fitzgerald Kennedy did just that. It was alleged that the JFK presidential campaign's success was due to considerable backing by the mob. The mob hoped that having a president in their pocket would secure their illegitimate enterprise. However, their plans backfired, and upon being elected President of the United States, Kennedy waged an all-out war on organized crime. A few years later, he lay dead. The events surrounding the assassination are ultimately deeply rooted in the money game. Fidel Castro, in 1959, waged a bloody war against the Cuban dictator, General Batista. The mob saw the potential of an open market in Cuba, and with the help of the CIA providing financial support via the mafia to ensure Fidel Castro's rise to power. In 1960, when Castro succeeded as dictator of Cuba, he ousted the mafia. U.S. businesses and agricultural estates were expropriated. Cuba then formed a trade alliance with the greatest enemy of the USA, Russia. And thus was sown the seed of a lifelong discord between Cuba and the US. Why does the US have an inherent hatred for Fidel Castro? Why does America fear this man's doctrines? Fidel Castro is one of the few men who has been wise to the propaganda and capitalist aims of the Western governments. He and his country endured in hostile climates, intact and unbroken, independent of capitalist control. When Fidel Castro turned to Russia, he became the first Western Atlantic country to become communist. This closed the door to the billions of enterprise that lay in Cuba for American investors. The Mafia was looking for a country where they could operate above the law. Castro denied them this sordid privilege. The result for communist Cuba was years of sanctions and negative propaganda. Cuba was forced into a state of abject poverty. The silent war of attrition saw many presidents pass before Castro, with the intention to break him, and thus force open the doors to American enterprise and trade. A trade that, as in the case of Puerto Rico, sucks a country of its resources while filling the bellies of American capitalists on American soil. With war on the horizon, large contracts have to be issued. Someone needs to make the weapons of mass destruction, medicine, guns, and computers. In Britain and the US, gun companies and shipping yards have generated stores of wealth. In 1974, a Soviet diesel submarine with nuclear capability sunk to its death a few hundred miles off the coast of Hawaii. In one of the largest salvage covert operations of all time, the US government security contracted multi-billionaire Howard Hughes for a two-year project worth millions. Howard Hughes was to use his industrial might and competence to design and build the mighty vessel to carry out the operation. One of the largest ships of the day was constructed to secretly hoist the wrecked submarine from its watery grave. The nature and details of this recon mission until this day are darkly kept secrets. But it is for sure that war and rumors of war have for a long time been a source of great financial gain. Interest is a system designed where money loaned generates money as a principle of service. The money loaned is lost by way of spending while the debt endures. The debate concerning interest on the social-economic platform is not a new thing. The philosopher Plato regarded interest as a means where the rich could exploit the poor. Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, believed that money was to serve as an exchange and not as a means to profit by use of interest. In the religious text of the Torah, Deuteronomy 23, interest is prohibited. You are not to exact interest on a fellow man. Whether it be money or food or anything else, interest cannot be charged. This was conveniently interpreted, however, by some Jews to mean Jew to Jew, hence making it legal to charge interest to non-Jews. At the Council of Nicaea in Christian era 325 AD, Emperor Constantine forged the Trinity, despite the strong opposition from the Christians of the time. However, on the subject of interest, the emperor failed to sway the uncompromising Christians. The church's decision was to cause friction for centuries in Europe. European merchants, in an attempt to circumvent the church, deployed many legal tricks, including one where three parties were involved. Contractus Trinus. Eventually, interest came to be charged in Europe in abundance, and eventually the church gave in neglecting the Bible in favor of democratic decree. In 1541, English law allowed the interest to be charged up to a fixed limit. Any excess of this was then considered unlawful. The church that had held out for centuries had finally given in completely. One Christian writer is noted as having stated that interest was necessary for salvation. Islam is the only religion on earth that incorporates in totality all aspects of a complete financial and government system. Islam thus combines the spiritual and the habitual. The issue of interest is made clear in the Holy Quran. O you who believe, fear God, and give up what remains of your claim of interest if you are truly believers. If you do not, then take notice of war from God and His apostles. In the history of Islam, there has never been any dispute by any person or persons, groups or individuals to this Quranic verse. An interest in Islam still remains forbidden. The interest-issuing groups who make billions upon billions have devised many ways to color and cloak many interest-generating systems. From bank accounts which accumulate interest, to credit card debts that are not settled before interest is applied. Many people who are adverse to interest are caught up in its web in some way or another. Today, many bank accounts incur interest, and this is unfortunately seen as not a big issue. However, it is. Both the gaining and the issuing of interest is clearly prohibited by God's law. It is very easy for customers to write letters to their high street branches and request that no interest be added to accounts in credit. O you who believe, fear God, and give up what remains of your claim of interest if you are truly believers. If you do not, then take notice of war from God and His apostles. They who control the credit of a nation direct the policy of government and hold in the palm of their hands the destiny of the people. After billions upon billions have been made, money as powerful and lust after as it is, wears thin. There is little lifestyle difference between someone with 20 million and 200 million. Money can only go so far. Power becomes the new sport, and world politics is the height of that game. It is fair to say a conscious or unconscious global banking conspiracy is in existence in our midst today. Names such as Barings of England, Rothschild, J.P. Morgan, Warburg. International bankers such as the Rothschilds are not the same type of bankers seen on the public high street. They deal with industrial giants of the world's institutions and local and foreign governments. The international banker creates the illusion that the money is being controlled by the government, when all the while it is being controlled by them. Rockefeller owns the Chase Bank, and the Warburgs own the Manhattan Bank. In a merger, the Chase Manhattan Bank was created. One of the most powerful conglomerates in existence, acting in consort with the Morgan banking dynasty. They spent millions of dollars to promote their campaign for legislation to gain a privatizing of U.S. money. They sold the idea to the public on the premise that current government legislation would work to propagate monopolies. Politicians all over the country cried for a new reform. To ensure a convincing case, the financial conglomerates publicly spoke out against these new policies, while secretly promoting it from the shadows. In December 1913, a short-staffed Congress voted in what was known as the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve is privately owned with stock held by 12 private banks, beyond and above the vote of the people. The President appoints 7 members to the Federal Reserve Board for a term of 14 years each. This serves to create the illusion that the government put into power by the voters ultimately control who governs this powerful body. However, no president in American history has appointed a member that is not congenial to the financial interest of the banking dynasties. The aim of the Federal Reserve Act, in essence, was propagated under the banner of removing money from politics. Many were and are still even today unaware that the Federal Reserve is a profit-making and private-owned corporation. Its aim, like most capitalist businesses, is first and foremost to profit. All other priorities are of a secondary nature. At the genesis of the Federal Reserve Act, the United States of America was divided into 12 federal districts, for which a board of directors was appointed. Trillions of dollars were made available to governments, businesses, and people, monies lent with the pending plague of interest attached. the U.S. government had spent more money than it had earned through taxation. The government then turned to the Federal Reserve to obtain money required to run the country. In this agreement, the government instructed the Treasury Department to print U.S. interest-bearing bonds. From the bonds obtained from the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve has created more and more credit, which it in turn loaned to businesses and individuals inclusive of pre-accumulated interest, establishing an ideal system whereby the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. The Federal Reserve in the U.S. serves as a line of credit when the government is in debt. The U.S. debt currently stands at $400 billion, which incurs $20 billion in interest per annum. Interest generated from nothing. Such power, reserved for those who control the money systems, is riddled with conspiracy and greed. Money manipulation by this one body shows how the influence and control of a few can affect the majority. Company plans, political prospects, rise and fall of certain industry, boom and depression, all controlled by the few. All controlled by money. The first Federal Reserve Board members were handpicked by Colonel Edward Mandell House, who represented British and American banking interest. Edward House, in 1912, wrote a supposed fiction novel entitled Philip Drew Administrator. The novel tells how a small group of insiders created a depression, then bring about the election of a handpicked leader, who launches a program called New Era. The insiders weaken the country to the point of civil war, which provides the excuse for the implementation of dictatorship policies. People, desperately looking for a way out, accept with open arms their new oppressor. This story seems very likening to actual U.S. historical events. Edward House selected Woodrow Wilson as a presidential candidate, and when Woodrow Wilson became nominated, he later became his financial advisor. Woodrow depended on him exclusively. He even admitted that House was his alter ego. The link between money and politics and ultimately the day-to-day lives of people is inseparable. In this complex chain, the simple conclusion is clear. He who controls the money controls the people. A global system influences the people who rise to power. Only those that support the ultimate interest of the big money dynasties will be selected. They in turn select judges, administrators, ambassadors, in a complex web that ultimately serves one master. The popular saying, two sides of the same coin, is just what summarizes this system. Political parties change, governments change, but this global system remains intact, and it begs the question, what group then sits at the head of this international table? In 1870, John Ruskin, an Oxford lecturer, taught to a group of his students that the state must take control of a country's production headed by one man, a man who was superior to all others. And amongst his students was none other than Cecil Rhodes, the ruthless racist dictator, who imposed his surname on what is now Zimbabwe. Cecil Rhodes, through his international banking contacts, amassed riches from creating a diamond and gold monopoly in Africa. In 1891, Cecil Rhodes established a secret society to promote the darker side of John Ruskin's dreams. Dr. Quidley explains.
In this secret society, Rhodes was to be leader. Stead, Brett, Lord Esher, and Milner were to form an executive committee. Arthur Lord Balfour, Sir Harry Johnston, Lord Rothschild, Albert Lord Grey, and others were listed as potential members of a circle of initiates. While there was to be an outer circle known as the Association of Helpers, later organized by Milner as the Roundtable Organization.
After the death of Cecil Rhodes, the leadership of this inner circle fell into the hands of Lord Alfred Milner, High Commissioner of South Africa. As director of numerous public banks and corporate precursor of England's Midland Bank, he became one of the greatest financial and political powers in the world. he recruited many Oxford graduates into his inner circle. Dr. Quidley explains.
Through his influence, these men were able to win influential posts in government and international finance, and became the dominant influence in British imperial and foreign affairs up to 1939. Under Milner in South Africa, they were known as Milner's Kindergarten until 1910. In 1909 to 1913, they organized semi-secret groups known as roundtable groups in the chief British dependencies and in the United States.
The Round Table preempted a secondary group in the United States called the CFR, the Council for Foreign Relations. It is through such organizations, universities, and tax-exempt groups that the global capitalist conspiracy has dominated and kept a grip on the world for over 50 years. The CFR was a front for financial giants such as J.P. Morgan, who ran it with the small but elusive American Round Table Group. The CFR has an elite membership of 1,400. They are sworn to secrecy, and the organization as a whole keeps a very low profile. One of the members, Joseph Kraff, in an article, Schools for Statesmen, published in Harper's Magazine 1958, stated one of the chief architects was Colonel Mandel House. He also stated that members of the CFR included the chairman of Atomic Industry, head of the CIA, members of the largest Wall Street giants, university lecturers, journalists from CBS, NBC, Newsweek, Times Magazine, Washington Post, directors from the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Endowment Fund, Presidents Hoover, Johnson, and Nixon. From media to presidents, the CFR has a very intimidating membership of some of the world's most powerful individuals for an organization the public knows next to nothing about. The question, so often asked, must once be asked again. What is the CFR? You can change the name, but the reality remains the same. Lodge, secret society, international bankers, Illuminati, it all equals one thing: control of public opinion and the elimination of religion. As intelligent as a person is, everything that is known is from the world around. By controlling the source of knowledge, i.e. universities, magazines, television, radio, music, etc., it is possible to fashion an organic robot which bows to the commands of its master. Some people believe that conspiracy is non-existent, and others believe everything is a conspiracy. Sometimes, the conspirators strangely encourage conspiracy. Through propaganda wars, the media conglomerates create enemies. Once it was Russia and communism, which dominated the post-World War II era. But now with the fall of communism, the new enemy is the so-called Muslim fanatic. Propaganda paints a conspiracy against religious bodies, causing the masses to react adversely to religion at the mere whisper of the word. The aim is to distance creation from the Creator and adopt God's role. The target of the negative propaganda has changed throughout the years, but the method of injecting this poison into the masses has not changed one bit. The creation of an enemy, real or illusionary, has been supported by the people who seem to have the most to lose, as mentioned before. The British banker that financed Trotsky, the communist revolution in Russia, was Lord Alfred Milner. The CFR has funded many left-wing idealists. Why? Lord House's fictional work, depicting how by creating an illusionary enemy can bring about the control of a people by only offering solutions which result in the desired outcome of the conspirators. The people see the proposed solution as a reasonable price to pay for the restoration of tranquility. Fear can create many things, and it is in this fear that some people make billions. It must be stated that a one-world government or a one-world economy is not flawed in its puritanical realm. It becomes tainted when the question of who runs it and why is asked. A world government based on the laws of God would be a perfect world to live in. What could be better? A system where morality and fairness remain unaltered by time. However, the pursuers of the global currency and global government are not the God-fearing kind, and it is this one factor that makes all the difference. They incited fear into the nations of the world. Fear created from an illusionary villain, intimidation. A common enemy needs a common reason for unification. They want no resistance to absolute control and economic growth and political steering of member states. Yes, America can give the world peace, but it is a piece of the expansion of the invisible American dictatorship. America has expanded its control beyond its borders. Anyone who opposes is propagated as an enemy of peace and equality. It has been a tool for the assimilation and manipulation of the resources of the world. America has no enemy. They have set up a climate favoring the World Bank and its policies and puppet governments. In 1944, at the international conference held in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, the IMF was born. Conceived from the ruins of a post-war Europe, the World Bank has created a vast web of exploitation and intrigue. Its victims, none other than potentially its greatest rivals, the so-called Third World countries. 800 delegates attended the Bretton Woods Conference at the invitation of the then President of the United States, F.D. Roosevelt. And it was at this conference, to a delegation still riddled by the ensuing wars, that America made its intentions clear. Free trade with no discrimination against U.S. goods. A favorable climate for American investment in foreign economies. And unimpeded access to raw materials. F.D. Roosevelt sold his policy on the back of the chimera that only free trade could guarantee post-war peace. Free trade equals equality. Equality equals peace. He argued that the 1930s Great Depression had allowed fascism to reign and that the currency disorders had destroyed the basis for international trade and investment. Bewilderment and bitterness had become the breeders of fascism, and fascism had led to a war America had to end. In 1960, the International Development Association, the IDA, was established. Its aim was to provide interest-free loans to the world's poorest countries, unable to afford the IBRD's terms of agreement. These loans gave an impression of being lenient. They are not. It is these loans from the IDA which are responsible for the present debt burden of today's poorest countries. Mexico, India, Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, China, Philippines, Argentina, Korea, Colombia, Morocco and Nigeria all still struggle under their financial burden that repayment of the IDA loans have created on their economies. Their peoples live lives of misery and squalor, and yet no one stands accountable. Hiding behind the mask of national reconstruction, it is the World Bank's intention to force Third World countries into submission and render them financially handicapped and politically weakened. And it is to Robert Strange McNamara, President of the World Bank, from April the 1st, 1968, to June the 30th, 1981, that credit is given. He masterminded the plot, which was to make the World Bank the most powerful establishment in the world. His previous role as United States Defense Secretary gave him first-hand knowledge of world systems, and how they might be manipulated and controlled. It was he who introduced the concept of the World Bank's moral obligation to relieve world poverty. McNamara's motives were undoubtedly political. Behind the zealous crusading front, McNamara was calculating and scheming. He wore the hat of political activist as a means to an end. And it was in this crusading disguise that the World Bank began its strategic domination of the poorer nations of the world. Third World countries were recklessly bombarded with IDA loans. The borrowing governments rarely refused a loan or worried about their position to repay it. To the investors, World Bank involvement signaled to the rest of the world that they had nothing to fear. It had become a necessary seal of approval. McNamara's final legacy had far more sinister consequences. His parting gift was the era of structural adjustment, known as policy-based lending. These loans came with inescapable conditions, insensitive to the individual and cultural needs of the countries involved. conditions which possessed the ambition of transforming entire societies, setting a new set of westernized social goals. Programs that have since devastated the lives of millions of people, whilst making the World Bank very rich indeed. McNamara's prime concern was in fact to obtain a state of general stability for himself and his country. His solution to the dreaded communist threat was not to eradicate poverty, as he pretended, but to bring poorer nations under his control. It was not his intention to create conditions for economic and social progress in the lesser developed areas of the world, but in fact to create a system so entangled and indebted to America as to remove any threat of political rebellion. By fueling the irrationally and self-destructiveness of unbridled emotion, greed, aggressiveness, hatred, ignorance, and inertia, the World Bank has brought many, if not all, third world countries to submission. Order, stability, and security for the North has been obtained through elimination of any political, financial, or social opposition. Although McNamara left the bank more than a decade ago, his policies hauntingly remain. In 1979, the World Bank launched its careful devised lending systems in the form of structural adjustment loans and pectoral adjustment loans. These loans tap into the very core of a country's political and financial infrastructure and spread like a disease to its peoples. The main incentive of the bank's loans is to liberalize the rules and regulations of a country in a direction favorable to America and Americans. With four types of loans and the capacity to coordinate them strategically, the World Bank controls many aspects of investments, institutional development, and public policy in nearly 150 nations. High African officials say TINA, short for There Is No Other Alternative, a vicious web of catch-22s from which there is no return. The World Bank has to be held accountable. And yet the bank continues unopposed, preaching market theology and avoiding the consequences of those misreadings. The bank wins, whatever the final outcome. The quest for money has led to an insatiable greed on the part of many large industries and businesses. Millions are spent on learning behavioral patterns of people to predict spending patterns and trends. Psychologists, economists, and marketing specialists are constantly employed by major corporations to typecast and analyze to the point where people are just numbers and points on a graph in obscure computer programs. The data is crunched in complex algorithms and program queries with one intention, predicting and controlling others. This information allows analysts to market products with such precision as to be able to predict consumers' response with almost assured success. This technique has been so refined that sales predictions are almost 100% accurate. Loyalty cards are an effective tool used to monitor general consumer habits. Do you have a loyalty card? Is often the first utterance to greet customers at checkout points. Loyalty cards often bear the name of the store. Sainsbury's card and Shell card are but two of thousands in the UK alone. They all work on a similar basis. The more money you spend, the more points you accumulate. At specific point levels, you're entitled to gifts or cash back. On the surface, the name loyalty card guarantees just that, customer loyalty. It is in the consumer's interest to stay with one store or chain and accumulate points, as cards are not transferable. There is nothing wrong with that, except the agenda goes deeper. When you are given a loyalty card, you fill in all your details and the card is processed and activated in a computer database. Every purchase you make from this point on can now be monitored. How much money was spent? On what was it spent? When was it spent? How frequent? A marketing manager's dream. In addition, your every movement is monitored by security cameras within the store. This highlights which aisles attract the most people. Do you buy bread first, followed by butter? Which products are not of interest to you? How did you respond to new marketing gimmicks in the store? Your general buying decisions. All of this information is at their disposal to be analyzed and deciphered until you become as predictable as a mathematical equation. Information can then be banded together into groups of single men, women, couples, families, etc. This information can then be sold to third parties for exorbitant amounts. McDonald's, one of the world's largest fast food giants, takes marketing research to another level. It hires low Earth orbit satellite time to conduct population development surveys. This information is used in the geo-positioning of future stores. From the Islamic Holy Land to the poorest country in Africa, McDonald's has found itself a home within almost every potential money market. Tapping into the resources of young and fragile economies, piping illusionary concepts of an American dream full of excess, waste, and greed. Concepts and ideas, the very nature of which ultimately destroy any country not operating at the Western economic level. To these major chains, money is their prime concern. All other issues, including the welfare of a people, are superseded. What can and what cannot make money is a very interesting subject. These days, it seems that there are very little niche ventures that are not profit-making. Even selling obscure plots of land on Mars has been done. In light of the new Martian mission, Search for Life, some real estate agents have been selling plots of Martian land. Strangely, in the US, this practice is finding clientele, and it is not even illegal. Fear and all its components is another good sales tactic. Either create a fear of someone losing something or create a fear of an event coming. The best example of this is the mysterious Millennium Bug, which failed to show up for the Millennium celebrations. Nonetheless, books were written about it, computer programmers were in demand, software came with the Y2K seal of approval. Computer consultants were running amok, and for what? For money. It is hard to estimate how much money was earned by the service cure end of the industry. Possibly billions. All on one word. Fear. If ever man created anything from nothing, it is money. Economists use the term created because the modern concept of money is a non-existent artificial term. A woodsman makes a house, but the wood is from the trees. Automobiles are made by man, but all the materials involved are created by God. Man has merely reinterpreted the raw materials to suit a specific purpose. Money wants a bit of paper, is today a mere electronic cyber pulse. The value of this paper, or electronic pulse, is negligible. Yet it can be used to build a house, buy a car, a boat, or even a cup of coffee. All acquirable through the same note or electronic pulse. And so it is to nothing a value is assigned. A value whose worth we must all collectively believe in. Without this belief, money would have no value. America has grown into the wealthiest nation on earth, a society built on capitalist principles and consumerism. The whole first world bows to the calling of money. Donald Trump.
Money for me is that it really is just a scorecard. It tells you if you've done well or if you've done badly. It really is just a scorecard.
Just a scorecard.
Those who own it are revered, and those that don't are scoffed. Money seems to buy respect in the capitalist jungles of the world today. Extravagant Hollywood stars display this excess beyond practical purposes to a dazzled public, while the majority of the human race suffers a sub-animal existence.
I think the show of wealth in my case really is the great buildings that I built. Trump International Hotel and Tower, Trump Tower. I own the Empire State Building. I own 40 Wall Street, which is one of the great buildings in the world. I love great buildings. And in a way, that's a show of wealth. But at the same time, it's something that just has made me a lot of money.
Money is worshipped as a religion in the West. The pursuit of it is an addictive one. Supply never satisfies demand. Husbands are constantly working overtime to get that extra dollar. Wives work long hours to supplement their husband's income. Children seek jobs to supplement their spending money, as they too, at a very early age, join the consumer assemblage. Money is that fleeting illusion, that carrot on the stick, forever pursued, yet never attained. The word money dominates Western conversation and is the silent underlying evil that gnaws away at its foundation. The world has been intentionally kept in ignorance. Ignorant people are easily controlled, easily convinced, and easily predicted. Education and knowledge make people interact with wise eyes, aware of the reality of a system intent on governing their destinies. A system that favors the robot to the enlightened. A system that detracts from the pursuit of knowledge of self, the world, and God. Money, though essential for survival, needs, like every other aspect of our lives, to be balanced. If its pursuit deadens the soul, then what we are as a people dies. Money, they say, cannot buy the things that really matter. Love, happiness, friendship, a beautiful place in the hereafter. Money is of this world, and like everything of this world, it will perish.